We have Matthew Fleener. He'll be talking on nature as special revelation, scientists as 21st century, monastics and glory as voice. Welcome.
Thanks for the opportunity to be here. I have to log back in to turn my timer back on. All right. As scientists, we observe creation active in its diversity, fruitful in its abundance, resilient in its regeneration. Consider the number of species and the alteration of those species that has come about, both naturally and through human ingenuity. Think about the renewal of the land and the habitat after natural processes like volcanism or human foolishness have ravished it. As scientists, it is our delight to observe, to measure, and to ponder this replenishing world. As followers of Jesus, we understand God to be a creator, a loving creator. As a creator, I also believe that God cannot contain the desire to reveal in relationship with those made in God's image, in creation that is endowed with God's being or in God's character. Can, and if so, how can the mission of God, the Missio Dei, include the created and natural world in which we live and move and have our being? As attenders of this conference, as members of the ASA, you are seeking a way of truth to connect these two great passions. That is the reason for which I came to Tulsa, the reason that I continue to search. What is our best opportunity to live in connection, in wholeness, with these two great passions, the natural world and the revealing God? In the remaining moments, I will share some ways that I have experienced connection, which may be applicable and implementable for you. Although we may describe the world as natural, I believe this revealing is special and unique. I begin with two concepts outside the realm of science which have aided my search for connection and unity. One is an external concept and the other internal. Much opinion has been drawn over Gerard Manley Hopkins' concept of inscape. In fact, I was a little nervous that Dr. McGrath was going to mention some of his thoughts about it. Inscape, according to Jim Cotter, another author, was Hopkins' concept to describe the divine bubbling forth of being within the created world. Inscape refers not only to the uniqueness of the individual thing or object, but also the manner in which that individual fits into the context and that object into the mind of the observer. For Hopkins and his delightful play on words, if you're familiar with them, scape derives its meaning from scope, which means to aim or to mark. Consider these thoughts about inscape from Hopkins' journals. But indeed, I have often felt how fast the inscape holds a thing. Green-white tufts of long-bleached grass like heads of hair or the crowns of heads of hair, each whorl of slender curves. I saw the inscape freshly, as if my eye were growing, though with a companion, the eye and the ear are for the most part shut, and in stress cannot come. For Hopkins, nature has an aim or a mark, an inscape that can be observed and which stresses the observer. While inscape refers primarily to something exterior, the concept of adequatio refers to our internal quality or qualities. From Plotinus, we learn that knowing demands the organ be fitted to the object. And then E.F. Schumacher, commenting on that, says even something more stringent, nothing can be perceived without an appropriate organ of perception. Certainly our adequatio is somewhat fulfilled through our professional training, but it seems that with regard to inscape, something more is required. Inscape seems to demand awareness and attentiveness to the present moment. So then a proper question follows. How can I increase my daily awareness of the present moment and my attentiveness to my work that involves the natural world. If awareness and attention to the present moment are keys to making me more adequate to discovering and hearing the voice of being, then monasticism seems to be a proper teacher. Within the Benedictine tradition of Christian monasticism, monks understand the present moment as the primal place of interfacing with God. Because both God and Jesus have revealed themselves through the present simple I am, awareness within the present moment is a valuable commodity for monks. As I've already suggested, there are already some commonalities between monks and scientists in the abstract itself. We spend a fair bit of time in silence. We spend a lot of time pondering and ruminating, as do monks. However, beyond these, there are two particular practices utilized by monastics that I have found aid with my own awareness. The number one activity of a monk is prayer. You can imagine survey says kind of thing. I'm sure we would all sort of chime in. Monks pray. Monks that live by the rule of Saint Benedict pray the Psalms at 7 explicit times per day. For years, the reason why monks prayed so frequently remained obscure to me. The hope of the monk in this daily routine is to segment the days into intervals so that the presence of God will not be far from him or her. Prayer is practiced at regular intervals in hopes of facilitating continual prayer between those regular intervals. And as André Louf says, the monk's vision is purified in prayer. His outlook on the work is refined and transfigured. So this idea of prayer in monastic literature, where we think in my sort of Protestant tradition that I go off and pray, for the monk, the prayer and the attentiveness to the present moment are co-equal. Over the past 15 years, I have attempted to supplement my workday with a noon prayer walk or visit to a nearby chapel. The Psalms encourage this atmosphere of awareness, the grittiness of daily life and emotions internally. More fully attentive, hopefully, I am, to the people and the activities of each day. The second activity, or practice, is the implementation of a repetitive prayer word. A common occupational hazard of academics and most scientists is to get lost in our mind speak. The constant commentary in my head, I won't speak for yours, is not always scientific or spiritual. In fact, mostly not the case. And it needs to be broken regularly if I am to be attentive and aware. In his very practical book, Into the Silent Land, Martin Laird suggests the disease in question is the overactive mind, which obscures the deeper ground of being. The prayer word is something like a vaccination. A small dose of the disease in question is introduced to the patient for the purpose of calling forth those antibodies that will ward off the disease. Further on, he says, the prayer word is like a mirror that reflects our own awareness. And then again, the prayer word, gently excavates the present moment. So again, you can see these practices are feeding into this desire, I think, and this need, I think, that we have to be aware and be attentive to the present if we're going to see this inscape and hear God's voice. So over the past 3 years, I have tried to practice breaking the commentary in my head by repeating the word or phrases associated with the word mercy. Psalm 79:8 in particular. May your mercy come quickly to meet us, for we are in desperate need. Louf says, again, that we're submerged and engulfed in mercy. So these kinds of phrases have helped me. Obviously, this introduction begs the question, so does it work? With the remaining time, and unfortunately I forgot to reset my cutout, so it's black now. That's fine. So obviously this introduction begs the question, so does it work?
With the remaining time, I would like to share one example from my work as an astronomer and also a reflection on Psalm 29 that tie together, hopefully, the awareness of glory and the voice of God.
All right, so we're not going to drop off into science world. I'm going to try to keep it very light, and if you have questions about some things, then we can do that later. So basically, I look at clusters of galaxies. This is an example of a cluster of galaxies. Everything in this image, except for the things that look like diamonds, are galaxies. So those are the stars, and everything there is a galaxy. This is a fairly, astronomically speaking, a fairly small area of the sky, but a megaparsec is overwhelmingly large for any of us to comprehend. So we create units like this so we can talk about them.
Just so you can see.
Yeah, sure. So the idea here is that over the last 12 years, my focus of scientific study has been on galaxy evolution and the environmental factors that influence galaxy properties. To carry out this work, we utilize several wave bands. This is the optical, but also the radio and the X-ray, which I'm going to show you in a minute. To make arguments regarding the dynamics of the environments in question, the X-ray and the radio are essential. Without the radio and X-ray bands, we would be hopelessly lost in a quagmire of conjecture of what's happening dynamically. So this is a X-ray image now. Of course, it doesn't look like this. We contour them because our eyes don't see X-rays, of course, and thankfully they don't penetrate our atmosphere. But you can see that this is an overlay and that there are two peaks here of the X-ray, what we call creatively the northeast and southwest peaks. But what we find is that this northeast peak is actually a background, so we can actually get a redshift from that, which tells us the depth. And so this northeast peak is actually in the background. And so really the only thing that is dealing with the cluster is this southwest peak. And you'll notice that this southwest peak is coincident with what we call a compact group of galaxies, which is another story that is important. But you can see that the X-ray and the optical compact group all fit together quite nicely. And then the arrows here are going to point towards things that in the optical band, they hardly can be seen at all, and maybe arguably, although this one can. This one is so faint right here that you can't even see it with the optical, or barely. But in the radio, however, these galaxies light up. So these contours are sort of a science way of presenting this qualitative image, but they're like wisps of smoke. They're tendrils of radio emission, called synchrotron emission, that come from the jets of the internal black holes of these galaxies. But the science point here is that they're bent. Do you see how these contours are bent this way? And for this other galaxy down here on the bottom, they're bent again. Both of them are bent toward the center of this X-ray emission. And so dynamically, the argument that we made in astronomical speak is to think of this compact group of galaxies being like a pebble dropping in a pond, and you can see the circular waves expanding outward. And in the same way, when this compact group of galaxies falls in to this other cluster, the X-ray gas is like ripples in a pond. And what we see, we see this ripple in the pond effect by the bending of the radio emission. Now, the point and takeaway here is not necessarily anything astronomical. Well, astronomy related. Yes, thank you. I'm glad you're listening. Through the opening of my awareness, now we're back to awareness and attentiveness. Through the opening of my awareness, not necessarily anything about redshifts of galaxies, but just the idea that multi-wavelength synthesis has taught me that my conception of God has been far too narrow and localized. Because the optical waveband is that which is most familiar and most accessible to me,
I usually forget that the other wave bands are present, except we remember them more now, right? We all know that the visible electromagnetic spectrum comprises only a small portion of the vast array of detectable wave bands. Is it possible that I'm only accessing, that I'm only aware of a small portion of what God is doing or who God is? It seems that what we have to gain by increased awareness while practicing our science is the revelation of God's glory, which is often understood to be God's character. And that is what the psalmist calls the voice of God in Psalm 29. The voice of the Lord, excuse me. So it's not necessarily the results of our science that will aid necessarily in our understanding of God. Being more attentive and more aware in the midst of our work with the natural world is sufficient to hear God's voice. In Psalm 29, 7 times the voice of the Lord is mentioned alongside the interactions and observations with nature. Flood and storms, the sight and sound of electrical discharge, the smell of fresh cedar, the frolicking of playful animals, the feeling of the ground shaking. The only response of the temple worshipers is, and in his temple all cry glory. By connecting the voice of the Lord with the glory of the Lord observed in the natural world, I understand God's voice to be a reminder of the character of God, a reminder of God's presence. And possibly the psalmist does that as well, because at the end, you know, the end of the psalm says that the Lord provides peace for his people, the Lord provides strength for his people. For so many years, I longed to hear God's voice about a future decision or the meaning of past circumstances. And perhaps God wanted to meet me in the present moment to remind me of God's presence. Although we often desire localized answers and responses to our very specific questions, it seems that God ushers out our creativity, our own mission, as we hear God's voice that reminds us of God's character. God has taught me to be more aware and more attentive in the present moment where God's world, God's glory, and God's voice are active. So may you increase in awareness and attentiveness in the present moment as you practice your creative endeavors in God's magnificent world. May you see God's glory and hear God's voice. Thank you.
Questions. We have enough time, so we can just grill him to the floor. I'm just kidding.
That's okay. This is not my PhD dissertation.
Let me make a comment. I think I like the analogy, because I'm a biologist, and I like the analogy between prayer and vaccination, although I don't buy into it completely because it's not the way it's supposed to work, but I think I like it, by the way. And I have a question for you. I think.
Yep.
I'm not what you do, but I think there was a news couple of days back saying that there was an alignment of some kind of a planetary alignment that would have never been seen, that was seen only when at the time of birth of Jesus. Is that a hoax, or that is something to it?
So
just last week, a few weeks back.
Yes,
actually.
Yes, of course, it was Venus and Jupiter.
Okay.
The alignment of Venus and Jupiter is one possible explanation for the star that is referenced in the Gospels. But I would want to do some research about. I think I feel confident in saying that this has happened in between the time of Jesus and just last week.
Okay. So. Thank you very much. Other questions from the floor?
Well, first of all, just a pedantic comment. You posed the question, why do monks pray 7 times a day?
Uh-huh.
So it's the Psalm 119. 7 times a day do I praise you.
Right. Exactly. Day. Yes. Thank you for that.
But the more substantive question.
Sure.
You speak about discerning the voice of God and the character of God,
mm-hmm.
and nature. And I think the sort of reflection of the talk last night and Professor McGrath's as well. If we don't start out knowing the fundamental character of God revealed in Christ, then what we see in nature can often give us a very unsettling view of the character of God.
Sure, yeah, and I would say Psalm 29 sort of, I agree with you in the sense that Psalm 29 is sort of the axis on which the argument rotates. So I certainly would agree with McGrath's sort of categories 4 and 5 this morning, that we've got to have some beginning point to draw in something meaningful from our observations. Yes. Yeah. Yes.
I enjoyed your talk and also the material that it's kind of coming from. My question is, the thing that I find very interesting is how you can bring theology and science together in a sense, and like your topic of like, you know, is there any special revelation that we can get from nature, if you will? I talked with a person that's into bioinformatics about this, like integrating of science, theology, and philosophy. He said philosophy and theology kind of fit together fairly easily. Science and theology, in terms of the practical doing, you know, real scientific stuff, is a little bit harder to do. So my first question is, if you have any thoughts or things that you think where that might actually profitably then work together. I'm familiar with a lot of different science, religion kind of models, but I'm talking about some specific applications. Like the two areas I find most interesting are in bioinformatics, and also in astronomy / cosmology. It's probably more you might want to comment in terms of, you know, astronomy and cosmology.
Yeah. Good thoughts. Good statement. Good question. So I think just to go back to something that the gentleman mentioned here about the Psalms and the special revelation part. I don't want you to understand, I don't think anybody does, that in some way the electromagnetic spectrum was somehow speaking about this, that the crux of the argument and the crux of my understanding and awareness is from Psalm 29. I think astronomy and bioinformatics probably are the best interfaces between science and religion because of something that McGrath said explicitly this morning, namely that as science asks questions that it can't answer, and those two areas in particular are places where science is asking lots of questions and is also realizing at almost a rapid rate that they can't answer those questions. I usually tell people that science always asks more questions than it can answer. There will always be questions within the questions that are answered. So I guess I'm sympathetic, to answer your question now directly, the last part, to this idea that we've got to have some jumping off point. So I talk about having a diving board, and I oftentimes interface with my colleagues or with students, usually after they take my class or after they graduate, more directly about, you know, what's your diving board? Where are you jumping from? Because I think this presuppositional approach, this inductive approach, is the way that things are going, and the way that I find resonance with me. But, you know, just to go back to your question, I think when scientists are faced with questions for which they have no answer, I think those are the moments where they begin mostly to ask, okay, you know, is there, or when answers seem to conflict and don't fit together. So I'd be interested to hear more about your experiences.
I'm actually doing a talk this afternoon.
Okay.
Yeah, I'd be glad to.
Yeah, great. Thank you.
Any other questions? Yeah, 5 more minutes. You want to just ask the question to yourself and then answer them?
No, I'm a big believer in staying on time, oh, so right. I would rather.
Just give me 1 minute. I think the gentleman asked a question about bioinformatics. I teach bioinformatics, but I'm not going to discuss that. You are more than welcome to come out for a talk on Monday. I'm talking about biotechnology, genetic engineering, and designer babies. I won't touch upon that, but I'm going to talk about what is the beauty of DNA we have. And In fact, if you read the book by Francis Collins, he talked that DNA is actually a language of God. Okay, it's a beautiful thing to look at DNA, and that's what God speaks to us through that DNA. Okay, we have one more question.
Question for him.
Oh, yes.
Do you find when you pray that sometimes you get clues about your scientific work?
Yes. I think it's a function of clarity. But I do. I mean, I think God's voice is clarity in some ways. I mean, in some ways, the noise is so great in my daily activity that this awareness, this attentiveness, this present moment, it doesn't mean that God's not speaking always or often. But oftentimes when I'm praying, those are the moments when I take time to break and try to be attentive. So, yes. Yeah. Good question.
Thank you very much, sir.
Yeah, thank you.